He had also some rare characteristics for a deeply religious person: a passion for evolving technology, accompanied by a good grasp of scientific politics at a time when the two were not seen to be connected. In his time, Christianity was still essentially a pre-industrial belief system. The language and metaphors of mainstream Christianity in the 1940s and 1950s were still those of the Book of Common Prayer, and even young preachers were hardly one removed from an 18th-century pastoral society. Though somewhat naive, and desperately unconventional, Adamski was nevertheless one of the very first writers to think about modern space science and ancient theology in Christian terms. If some of his spiritual writing in connection with technology appears daft beyond belief, then at least he was one of the first people to think about such connections at all. He knew his Bible back to front, and was certainly the first to offer the kind of religio-scientific speculation that was to launch hundreds of books after his time. He discusses the UFO visions of Ezekiel some 10 years before Joseph Blumrich's The Spaceships of Ezekiel and von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods appeared. A passage from his third book, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery, shows the techno-theological view Blumrich and von Daniken inherited. Evidently, the early church came to believe the cherub was an angel because it was described as flying on wings. They had no knowledge of the nature of the space travelers and assumed that the ships were fire-breathing animals of some sort. They couldn't conceive of mechanical constructions made to navigate the heavens. I imagine the automobile would have been described as another type of angel or cherub, or perhaps as a demon or devil. It is as well to remember here that the idea of objective reality is a late and rather callow arrival on the historical scene. Certainly Shakespeare would not have understood it, for him mind and nature were a seamless robe. The important thing to realize here is that Adamski, despite his love of what he called science, lived quite happily for the most part in the visionary anthropomorphic world of the Old Testament, in which the idea of fact had not arrived. Thus the accusations of imposter which would later be thrust upon him are neither right nor wrong. In his terms, they were meaningless. If in William Blake's eyes, John Milton's sin was to make the Bible more glamorous and dramatic, then in modern eyes, George Adamski's sin was to try and update it. And in doing this he certainly convinced many of his followers that the forces that bound together the ancient world for millennia still existed, but in a fragmented and broken form that indeed mirrored the pattern of his own life. Perhaps Adamski felt a little like Moses when he came down from the mountain. The rawness of the actuality was perhaps too potent. This pure concentrate had to be staged, lit, and produced in easily digestible episodes. Thus did media begin. In choosing to tell stories, Jesus as a teacher did exactly the same thing. Thus we do not of that oldster, age-factual contradiction, beloved of simple-minded skeptics, but a belief system whose developing processes are spread over a wide and extremely fuzzy spectrum. Adamski got there, and then the event slipped through his fingers. What is a man to say of such an experience? A comment by Gray Barker, in his book of Adamski, sheds light on Adamski's transparent homespun Christian honesty on the one hand and the source of some of his fabrications on the other. Something real, though weird and fantastic, happens to an individual and he tells the world about it. People come from miles around to hear the story, and then want to hear more. The saucer contactee may similarly concoct further accounts, not wishing to disappoint his public. The consequence of accepting such a situation means that we must recognize a new kind of event in the universe. We might call this kind of event a fast transient. Acceptance of such an event means that we may replace the old yes, no paradigm with perhaps and the working, not working paradigm with working, not working very well. There was never a man and woman born who did not at some time tell a tale about themselves, elaborate on a personal experience, if only to put themselves in the best possible light. If we do not have some love for ourselves as well as other people, we often become sick in body and mind. All thought begins in the great imagination, and in the context of evolving life and experience, every single one of us can be caught out by a past statement, opinion, letter, or even publication. As weary researchers in artificial intelligence sadly admit, the mind does anything but reason by facts. It reasons by hypocrisy, downright confusion, mistakes, selective amnesia, and often monstrous self-deception. The ultimate nightmare of the democrat and rationalist is that when all this anomalous noise is filtered out, the mind becomes little more than a car park papered over with ancient copies of 7 Volts Guide. When that happens, the living are indistinguishable from the vast hosts of the dead. There is a photograph of Adamski taken in the interwar years showing him preaching from a lectern and surrounded by plaster images and paintings of Christ that by most standards would be called kitsch. Though he looks certainly like a young carpetbagger about to abscond with the collection box, by any and every account of friends, associates, and co-workers, his craggy and formidable looks belied his nature. From his thousands of followers over the years, there has not been a single complaint of the vicious physical and financial exploitation we have now come to expect of many of fringe religion preachers throughout the world. Yes, his co-author Desmond Leslie remarks on his more than occasional stubbornness, Lucy McGuinness, his secretary for many years, talks of his ego, and Zinstig is often suspicious of many things he said and did, but it doesn't amount to much as criminal fraud and deception are concerned. Adamski's first book, Wisdom of the Masters of the Far East, was published by the Lagbana-based Royal Order of Tibet in 1936. This was the first in a series of booklets and pamphlets he was to write, and despite their often naive thought and expression, they gave him quite a following. Telepathy, the cosmic or universal language, and science of life study course were both developed continuously after 1936 and sold as a mail order course of 12 lessons, one per month. Much of this material was broadcast by local radio stations Fox Long Beach, KMPC Los Angeles, and various Beverly Hills stations. In 1940, being beyond the age for military service, Adamski moved with his wife and a group of his students in Universal Law to Valley Center Ranch, which was along the route to the foot of Mount Palomar, whose peak is the site of the world-renowned 200-inch optical telescope. There the group, united by a common religious interest, formed a small self-help farming community, hoping to grow enough produce to support themselves and sell to others. Adamski continued to lecture, often drawing large crowds. But in 1944, the ranch was sold and his friends, followers, and Universal Law pupils moved a few hundred feet up our mountain to live a candles and kerosene existence. Life was very hard in these mountain communities of the American West, given the war situation. Every possible resource was either in short supply or restricted. But Adamski, if not all that practical, Desmond Leslie remarks on his technical inability, was anything but a shirker, doing manual work and any odd jobs that came along. Perhaps the only equivalent Britain had to this kind of community in those days was the Findhorn community in Scotland, founded by Peter Cuddy and his wife Eileen in the 1950s. There have been stories in the press about a small community where the elemental world of plants and animals cooperate with fairies, elves, and gnomes in creating a land where nothing is impossible and legends are reborn, commented Paul Hawken in his book The Magic of Findhorn. In the Adamski context, the Don Juan and Tolkien combined atmosphere sounds familiar. But for the Palomar community, there were to be no 40-pound cabbages, 8-foot delphiniums and roses blooming in the snow, as at Findhorn. The wonders were late in arriving, but arrive they did. Often we see the saucers flashing overhead, wrote Adamski in 1955, describing what could be seen from his mountain home. In fact, in recent weeks the spaceships have been seen by many in neighboring towns and cities. We are content to know that they are above us, and in the skies of our Earth. We hope that in the not too far distant future all peoples in our world may see and know them for what they are, and we hope that many of those whose words we would convince, who do know now and would keep silence, will speak out in the interest of all mankind. The mountain commune cleared rough virgin land, and constructed some basic accommodation for the many people who came up the mountain to see Adamski and hear his lectures. After much effort, a kibbutz-style kitchen and living unit were built, the former cut into the side of the mountain, and equipped with outdoor chairs, benches, and picnic-style tables and a charcoal grill. In the early 1950s, there was as yet no electricity or water, but a freshwater stream, which ran down the side of the mountain, was tapped and piped into a pool with an outlet. Eventually lavatories and electricity arrived, courtesy of a friendly contractor. Adamski also worked with his wife selling ice cream, hot dogs, and hamburgers in a restaurant owned by his close friend and follower, Alice K. Wells. This restaurant served mainly the visitors and tourist parties who were going to Mount Palomar Observatory high on the mountain. Lou Zinstag makes the apartment comment that she never understood why, in a democracy, this fact did so much to damage his image. Perhaps the world still thinks as Shakespeare thought, that only those on the top of the social scale are capable of having intensely significant experiences. Certainly Adamski was conscious of his social and personal disadvantages in early 20th century America. Just as today, if you are somewhat swarthy, have a strong foreign accent, and sell hamburgers, you are nobody, whether you believe in flying saucers or not. Although I have lived in America since I was 1 year old, I still have an accent, wrote Adamski. And I have no college degrees. Then, too, there is much manual labor to be done around Palomar Gardens, and I did it. Some people cannot associate such things with a scientific atmosphere, nor see that the practical can make a very steady basis for scientific and philosophical outreaching. So they tried to discredit me. But I have never been deterred. Naturally enough, Adamski was always very sensitive about the hamburger vendor title some popular newspapers had given him. Even as late as 1999, the British X Factor magazine condescendingly refers to his hot dog stand. From this remark, we assume that for sound philosophy, first-class restaurants are absolutely essential. None of the apocryphal accounts of Alice K. Wells' modest establishment square with the description by Lucy McGuinness of the cafe as a place where hundreds of people from every part of the world came and went, month in, month out. Adamski says in Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery that even if the four-seat tale had been true, it would not have been to his discredit, for America is built upon the little fellows who made good. Though he protests in the same book that he was not employed in any capacity at the Palomar Gardens Cafe, there is evidence that he certainly helped out there quite often, if not actually being employed, since the commune he lived in hardly supported such a relationship in any case. He certainly lived on the cafe property with his wife, and the owner Alice K. Wells was a woman dear to his heart who helped create the George Adamski Foundation. He felt obliged to defend her and her enterprise. Palomar Gardens was far from being a hamburger stand, for it had been twice publicized in Holiday magazine. Be all this as it may, the restaurant was quite obviously the center of his social life, if only because his two telescopes were nearby. In Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery, Adamski gives a cameo of his life at this time as he acted as an unofficial public relations officer for the Palomar Observatory. The observatory had no one to give out information, so many people would ask questions at the cafe in regard to its operation. I often conversed with guests in the cafe dining room, on astronomy and other topics. When the spacecraft arrived, I was in a position to answer many questions and to give free lectures for service clubs. Between working at the restaurant and doing his duty as a first aid warden during the Second World War, he continued his lifelong interest in astronomy, and a 15-inch telescope came his way, which he housed in a slotted cupola. This Newtonian reflector was a miniature version of the Great Telescope on the top of the mountain, and financed by pupils' donations, sales of his books, and lectures and broadcasting. But the telescope he used to shoot most his famous flying saucer photographs was a much more useful tripod-mounted 6-inch Newtonian reflector. This had been given to him by a friend and student sometime in the late 1920s, and the firm which made it, Tinsley Laboratories, was long gone by the late 1940s. The bulky plate camera attached to it was therefore ancient but nevertheless still fine technology for its day. This telescope often stood in the parking lot by Alice Wells' cafe. With it he recorded things that the great telescope far above his hot plate either could not, or even did not want to see. As far as Adamski is concerned, the accusation of being a fantasist comes usually without reference to those operational 19th century fantasies without which Palomar Observatory could not have been built in the first place. Although Adamski states specifically in Flying Saucers Have Landed that he was not associated in any way with the Palomar Observatory, both his miniature equipment and his preoccupation created a peculiar and undeniable symbiotic relationship between himself and Palomar. Perched on our mountain, he acted as a warning sprite on a path of initiation to the machine high above him. Writers on any subject at all must not only take into account bare facts, they must be aware of simulacra and the alignment of symbols, the crosstalk between irony and image. All these things make up the vital fabric of individuals and events. Students of complementary simulacra might well take note of the contrast between the face of a human being and the face of Palomar Observatory. Undoubtedly, Palomar has what Norman Mailer would call a wasp face. Nothing could present a more clean and respectable bourgeois face than the serene white edifice of the world's largest optical telescope. At 5,600 feet, it rules over the landscape of California, a mighty Apollonian symbol of reason and mechanical triumph over nature. Compared to this powerful image, the gypsy features of Adamski are of Dionysus as Joker, with a hint of the sulphurous alchemical features of Chaos and Old Night. If these pan-dimensional matches have anything at all to teach us, it is that we must learn once more to read the long trails of cross-referencing metaphors. The almost falsehoods of this trail will lead us away from the almost truths of economics, finite social function, and scientific purpose. The Palomar telescope itself, with its 20-ton Pyrex mirror, was quite obsolete before it became operational in 1948. It cost $6 million, took 18 years to complete, and it stands now in the 21st century rather like a gorgeous 19th century folly. It is a veritable cathedral of early industrial age technology, beautiful as Chartres, yet as useless as an old mineshaft beam engine, or a communist five-year plan. But certainly in 1953, before the age of computers, space, and radio astronomy got into their stride, there was nothing to challenge Palomar as the supreme symbol of clean-limbed scientific and technological success. The Great Observatory represented the unsullied innocence of the science of 17th-century optics brought to almost decadent perfection. It was one of the last great white hopes before oiled seabirds were to litter the globe. The nuclear clock neared midnight, and big science was pitched headlong into its first polluted midlife crisis, and not a few greasy fingers were caught in the scientific till. Those postmodern thinkers who reason by metaphor and simulacra rather than by linear factual propaganda will have noted this conjunction of the great Palomar Observatory and George Adamski. Little did this powerful symbol of rationalist aristocracy know that it had a blue-chinned knave toiling away at a hot grill below stairs who was going to half-blow it away. For underscore all the world, it was as if the great house of Palomar had given birth to an unwanted son and had ordered him to the castle kitchen to cook burgers for visitors to the great dome on the hill. Apparently there were moments both confusing and amusing when tourists from far-flung domains encountered Adamski's cupola, his pseudo-Palomar, and were offered cut-price deals on frankfurters and cola by what many assumed to be the chief astronomer. The opinion the Palomar astronomers had of Adamski is reflected in an FBI report of 1953. The unnamed astronomer condescendingly refers to R. Adamski as an astrologer, and mentions that during World War II, Adamski called himself a reverend and conducted Easter services in the valley. As with the blinkered mere seller of Berger's remarks, the attitudes so well portrayed in Thomas Hardy's novel Jude the Obscure are still alive and well. C.P. Snow in The Physicist's Apostrophe 7 mentions that Otto Hahn, the German physicist who split the uranium atom, and who stayed behind to work with Heisenberg, once called Einstein the butler, Adamski is one of those individuals quite common in history whose facts don't add up. Like Adolf Hitler, he was a kind of metaphysical Pied Piper, though fortunately on the reverse side of the moral coin. It is not of much use to find a lie Adamski told in 1946, a tall tale he told in 1952, or a re-editing of experience that he published as real event. Like Hitler again, he is both phenomenon and man, and in his tumultuous wake follow extraordinary events and ideas, strange people, and bizarre conflicts and accusations that still rage today. In this sense, George Adamski was a most extraordinary individual who drew to him forces that were equally extraordinary. It seems that right from 1949, hamburger vendor or not, his life and opinions aroused military and scientific interest quite beyond all normal levels of expectation for a penniless man. Perhaps a man should never assume that he is so small and harmless that he has not been registered on the screens of Big Brother. Military men and scientists couldn't resist him, if only to savage his reputation. In drawing antagonism out of all proportion to the threat he represented, he was a living representation of that strange homeopathic theory which states that the more diluted the mix, the more effective is the power of the application. But perhaps those who create new metaphors that authority does not like are infinitely more dangerous than those who plant bombs. On the 9th of October 1946, Adamski with a group of his followers observed a gigantic spacecraft hovering above the mountain ridge south of Mount Palomar, towards San Diego. A local radio station that broadcast sightings confirmed the observation by others. A few weeks later he met a large group of people from San Diego in Alice Wells' cafe, and a discussion began about this sighting. Six military officers, he does not say which branch of the American armed forces, were dining there also, and they listened intently to the discussion. One of them spoke up, saying, "It is not as fantastic as it sounds. We know something about this." Adamski asked what they knew, but they would not tell him. Yet they assured us all that the ship we had seen and were discussing was not of this world. The much-publicized Kenneth Arnold sighting of June 24, 1947 quickened Adamski's interest. A few weeks after this event, accompanied by four friends, he watched scores of lights turn, bank, and maneuver in the night sky. The lights would reverse their path, and on occasion appeared to hovering around the central body, or dome. One light became stationary, shooting out two powerful beams of light, one towards the south and San Diego, the other north toward Mount Palomar. Another light appeared to be acting as a kind of leader before they all faded away like a squadron of passing aircraft. Tony Belmonte, a soil conservation employee who was living in a trailer on the same property, said he counted 184 of the lights or objects. He also told Adamski that a group of men from the Dempsey Ranch in Palmer Valley on the west side of Palomar had counted 204 of these lights or objects. Shortly after, two scientists on the way to the observatory came to see Adamski and asked if he had seen the lights, and he told them he had. They told him that Tony Belmont's count was accurate. Adamski commented that they would divulge little more than to assure me that all indications pointed to them being interplanetary, because they did not belong to our government. On a rainy day late in 1949, four men came into Alice Wells' restaurant. Two of the men, G. L. Bloom, and J. P. Maxfield, were scientists from Point Loma Naval Electronics Laboratory. The other two, one in uniform, possibly naval, Adamski does not name, but he does say that they were from what he terms a similar setup in Pasadena. These men told Adamski that although they had 48, 18, and 12-inch telescopes, they wanted to see what he could do with his 6-inch one. Though they said that this would be voluntary unpaid work, they did mention the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and pointed out a specific area of the moon, which they said they would like Adamski to concentrate on. They asked me if I would cooperate with them in trying to get photographs of strange craft moving low space, wrote Adamski, since I had smaller instruments than those at the big observatory. They said they were going to the top and ask for the same cooperation from the men at the big observatory. Thus right from the start of the post-war period, big systems and organizations, both military and scientific, were beginning to get interested and involved in what people like Adamski were saying and doing. Thus encouraged by the attention he was getting from serious and responsible folk, he bought new film and started a new watching regime. It was not long before he succeeded in getting two good pictures while observing the very area on the moon originally pointed out to him by the scientists. It was professional editing practice in these early days of books on flying saucers to dramatize real-life situations in a lurid B-feature script manner, quite unlike the cold and clinical technique common today. Donald Kehoe's earliest books, for example, are full of overscripted purple passages. While Adamski's books are not nearly as bad, the following scene from Flying Saucers Have Landed is straight from a Dash El Hamit film script of the time. I cannot remember the exact day except that it was during the time radio reports were being broadcast of a flying saucer landing in Mexico City. While we struggle to beat that for an opening sentence, we read on. I had just tuned in the 4 p.m. news from KMPC, Beverly Hills, California, when Mr. Bloom stepped into the place. He sat down beside me, next to the radio, and told me to be quiet and listen. After it was over, he made an odd remark. They did not give all of the truth. There was more than that to it. Adamski continues in a style that has been parodied countless times over half a century of films, radio, and television. Then I knew that he knew more about it, but he would not talk. He then says that he met some government men in Mexico a year later and they told him that indeed a spaceship had landed, but the story had been suppressed because of fear of a rising panic amongst Mexico's superstitious population. Before Bloom left, Adamski handed him prints of the two photographs he had taken, asking him to let his colleague Mr. Maxfield have a look at them. On the 21st of March 1950, some months after the Bloom visit, Adamski gave a lecture to the Everyman's Club in La Mesa, California. Sanford Jarrell, a reporter from the Daily San Diego Journal, was present, and gave the lecture a front-page report the next day. However, he did not mention the two prints the Point Loma scientist had taken away with him, a matter he had privately discussed with Adamski. On the 22nd, the San Diego Union and Tribune smelt out the story, and contacted Adamski, who in turn referred them back to the Point Loma scientists. The newspapers could get nothing from the Navy laboratory, and so they asked the Pentagon. On the 29th of March, by way of Copley Press leased wire from Washington, the Pentagon denied everything. The two scientists concerned were important enough to have full autobiographical entries in American Men of Science, 9th edition, Volume 1. In 1957, the then editor of Flying Saucer Review, Waveney Girvan, wrote a letter to the employment superintendent of Point Loma asking about the whereabouts of Maxfield and Bloom. The reply stated that the former no longer worked at the laboratory, but Bloom was currently employed. A further letter inquiring of Bloom personally whether he had indeed been interested in trying to obtain photographs of saucers in 1949 remains unanswered to this day. After his success with two good photographs, Adamski got virtually nothing for the next year and a half. Often sleeping in a hammock slung nearby, he describes very beautifully, in terms of temperature, climate, and animal and bird life, the nights he spent watching during these many months. From the summer and fall of 1951 through 1952 he took something like 500 photographs, of which only a few were suggestive of any kind of craft. In July 1951 Fate magazine published an article of his, which helped him financially and also initiated many inquiries about his pictures, for which he reluctantly asked a small payment. To this day, there is no proof that any of these photographs were forgeries. Adamski says himself that he had no desire to prostitute so profound a subject nor make a mockery out of so unprecedented a happening. In any case, the plates he used were very old-fashioned plates even at that time, and the obsolete equipment he used did not easily lend itself to experiment without leaving over obvious traces of interference. All his print developing, or finishing as it was called then, was done by an expert on this vintage equipment, a Mr. DJ Detweiler, who lived in Carlsbad, about 40 miles from Palmer Gardens.